This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. Jay Hanselman filling in today for Mark Haney. Today we're discussing news headlines of the week. Joining me are WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn, executive producer and chief investigative reporter for Channel 9, Craig Cheatham, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100, or you can email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, again, 513-419-7100. And thank you all for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely.
Craig, I'm told you kind of spearheaded this project that we're going to talk about first, and that's the issue of folks who are dealing heroin, and when they're arrested, what happens to them. And your reporting has found that more often than not in Hamilton County, they're sentenced to probation or some other community service rather than jail time. So tell us about what you found.
Well, Lisa and I worked on the project together, and we identified 164 convicted heroin traffickers who were charged, convicted, and sentenced within the last 13 months. We did that because we wanted to make sure that we followed these defendants all the way through the process and that the cases were as recent as possible, because that would tell us essentially what's going on right now.
Absolutely.
And so out of that 164, I looked at the charges, the indictment, bill of particulars, which will have more details than the original indictment, the sentencing, and the plea bargains. And in every case, there was a plea bargain.
All 164 cases, there was a plea bargain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's very common. Out of the 164 defendants, 155 were African American or are African American, and the other nine are white. We found that 43% of those defendants received probation. We found that there were defendants who had been convicted of drug trafficking three, four times, who got probation on the fourth or fifth time. We found that there were nine repeat drug traffickers who were on probation, and seven of them violated their probation. And many of these
guys.
That's
within that 13-month period.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
We had people who violated their probation repeatedly and were kept on probation. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things when people look at these records, you'll see that the judge typically has a line in there, and it says something to the effect of, if you violate your probation, you'll go to prison for 12 months. And what we found many times is that they did not go to prison.
What normally, and obviously I'm a reporter, Howard's a reporter, normally this starts with a gem of an idea. So what caused you to say, I want to look at these? What was the gem of the idea that started this investigation?
Well, I requested spreadsheets from the Hamilton County Clerk of Courts, and we were looking at three different types of criminal charges. Heroin is such a huge problem in the tri-state. And quite frankly, it's to the degree that I've not seen any of the other places where I've lived. And so it seemed obvious to focus on, you know, how is the justice system treating the people who get caught with it, not only the users, but the people that are providing it. And so we've examined thousands of criminal charges. Some of them have been dismissed or pleaded down. From maybe a trafficking to a possession, and this 164 we focused on were the ones that I could find, not only through the spreadsheet that was provided to me, but also doing a follow-up search on the Hamilton County website for any cases that met the criminal code for drug trafficking.
Lisa, let me give you a chance to jump in here.
Yeah, absolutely. As we took these findings to law enforcement in the community and started getting responses and reaction from them, what I heard was, you know, they were most concerned about the cases that involved fentanyl and carfentanyl, these synthetic drugs that increasingly have hit the streets in our region.
And have been deadly.
And are you know,
so much more powerful.
Up to 10,000 times more powerful than heroin.
Right.
And of those cases, more than 50% of the folks convicted are getting probation. There are other states that have lobbied for stiffer penalties for dealers convicted of, you know, selling fentanyl and carfentanil. There's folks here in Ohio that want to see that happen. So it's the, you know, these specific synthetic drugs that really have law enforcement most concerned.
Craig, you brought several cases, or you have, you know, cases that you looked at. Are there a couple that you'd like to highlight that that you know, draw attention to that and bring out the your report?
Sure. Well, one of the things that we found, we looked at several subgroups. We looked at people who were convicted of repeated felonies. We looked at people who were sentenced to probation, how they behaved on probation. And in addition to that, we looked at this subgroup of defendants who were convicted of trafficking, not only in heroin, but also fentanyl and carfentanil. And half of them, half of the ones who also had fentanyl or carfentanil, got probation. And in addition to that, we found three cases where people were convicted of trafficking in carfentanil and they got probation.
I think there was one line in your story, as I recall, that where you were talking about one would assume the more of a drug that you sell, that the penalty would be more harsh.
Right.
But you found in some cases that people who were selling less got a stiffer penalty than those who were selling the larger volume.
Yeah, we found a guy who the police arrested for 10 to 50 grams of heroin and carfentanil. And he got probation. And then 3 weeks after he got out on probation, they relaxed that probation. We found another guy who was convicted of selling less than a gram of heroin at a time, which is an extremely small amount for trafficking. And he was sentenced to 12 months in prison.
What about this argument that you hear that, okay, the prisons are overcrowded. We have no place to put these people. And, you know, that's why a lot of these people are being cut loose. Does it make any sense?
So when, you know, the folks that I'm talking to, the law enforcement, they're saying, we understand right. That's a challenge. That's been a challenge for quite
many
some
years.
Yes, for quite some time. And work has been underway to, you know, lots of reforms in place for criminal sentencing, right? But when it comes to the size and scope of the heroin problem across our community and across Ohio, there are law enforcement who say we can't back down from this right now, that there should be these stiffer penalties in place, especially for the fentanyl and carfentanil.
Right. And that's because these are drugs that can and do kill people.
Absolutely. I mean, over the last 2 years, just in Hamilton County, almost 300 deaths from heroin overdoses, including fentanyl and carfentanil. You know, you look at the impact on community services in terms of responses to these overdoses, you know, overwhelmed emergency rooms. I mean, the impacts are enormous.
So I would think that law enforcement people, the police, the people who actually arrest these people and gather the evidence, would probably make the argument, hey, look, if there's room in prison, it should be for these people.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, the legislators that we've talked to so far have said, we agree possibly that this is, you know, a path that we should go down in terms of these stiffer penalties. But until more sentencing reform takes place, we're just not going to have room for them.
One thing that comes up, and I know it's been discussed with a lot of these task force efforts and response to the heroin crisis, is this idea of treatment. But I would assume that treatment necessarily for the dealers wouldn't – that's not going to make any difference on jail space.
That's a really you know, that's a really blurry line for when it comes to sentencing. As we talk to law enforcement, they understand that, you know, treatment can many times be more effective longer term for those users that, you know, have a history of drug addiction. But when it comes to plea deals, et cetera, separating out those traffickers who are solely in this for profit and who keep returning to our communities and causing this devastation from the users, it can get really tricky in court.
And many of the dealers are users.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean that they're addicted. But there are many of them who do use, and as part of their probation, they are sentenced to treatment programs.
And for those listening, we're not ignoring the obvious of the prosecutor's response to that. I want to save that till after our break because that could get lengthy. But we will get to the prosecutor's response. Obviously, you looked at Hamilton County. Do you plan to compare other counties in Ohio, other states? I mean, is this just the first step in this process?
I see it as the first step. You know, it'll be very difficult to get a similar amount of data from some of the other counties. I mean, we'll try, yeah. But I think what people need to understand when they look over our shoulder at what we've done and the way we tried to do it is this was an enormous effort. I mean, I personally looked at over 4,000 pages of documents. I mean, every single case, you're looking at a half dozen type of documents. We're going back into the criminal histories of these guys. I mean, it's an exhausting effort. It really is. Mm-hmm. And would I like to duplicate that in other counties? I mean, I think Lisa would too. But, you know, do we have the time for it? Do we, you know, how far do we go with it? I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I think in terms of looking at the impact the heroin epidemic is having across our community, yes, we'd love to know county by county this kind of granular level data, right? You know, so and I would think that decision makers, you know, in Hamilton County would want to know this as well. Knowing how many folks are returning to the community who have been convicted of dealing these drugs is, I think, would be top of mind when we think about what's the plan of attack as we continue to move forward. So hopefully we can keep digging and, you know, we'll have some findings that help inform the decisions that are really complicated and tough for our leaders.
I mean, we're not saying that we're not saying that all of these guys should be in prison. What we're saying is that you have people in our community who are a persistent threat to public safety and people's lives. How do you treat that? It's a very complicated system. You got health care. You got, punishment by locking them up. You got rehabilitation. You've got finances that the government has to be accountable for. I mean, it's very tough.
And what we hear from law enforcement is what we're doing right now isn't working, that these numbers prove that.
How much of this comes down to sentencing latitude for a judge to decide? I mean, part of this, I'm sure, is written into statute, but then ultimately it's up to a judge to impose a sentence. So I would assume that they've got latitude.
So that's part of the challenge, right? So in part, judges' hands are tied. You know, in Ohio, you can hand down these stiffer penalties for certain drug dealers if they're convicted of selling in bulk amounts. And for heroin, that's 10 to 50 grams. Because of some of the criminal sentencing reforms that have happened in recent years, those lower level felonies, so those dealers that are dealing less than that 10 gram level, are often put on probation. But when you talk to law enforcement, they're telling us it's not the bulk dealers that are out there that are having the biggest impact in our community. It's the dealers that are out there selling. They know what kind of case they might catch, right? So they carry less of the drug on them. And so they're saying we need to go after these smaller dealers to have a bigger impact.
And like I said, we found people that were sent to prison for less than a gram. And the young man who was convicted of trafficking a carfentanil had 10 to 50 grams. So that's exactly the example that Lisa gave us.
Yeah.
We are talking about a story that Channel 9 did on heroin dealers and their sentences for doing that. And as promised, after the break, we'll hear what the Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters has responded to this report, but not to Channel 9. It's our local Friday news review today, and our conversation will continue in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in today for Mark Haney. Today we're discussing news headlines of the week, and joining me are WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn, executive producer and chief investigative reporter for Channel 9 Craig Cheatham, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, and we're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, if you have a question or comment, 513-419-7100. And as promised, a lot of this would involve the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office and County Prosecutor Joe Dieters. Did you try to interview him, talk to him for your report?
Oh, yeah.
And what was the response?
Well, I made several requests, both verbally and in writing. And, you know, they didn't rule it out for a little while. And eventually I was told that he was not going to be available. I actually sent them quite a bit of information about our story. I sent them a spreadsheet early on that probably had, I don't know, 50, 60 cases on it, something I can't remember ever doing on a story, and probably some journalists would frown on that. But I told them that I wanted to get detailed, direct answers to the questions that we were going to have and the cases that I wanted to discuss. And I felt like the only way to do that and be fair was to tell them what cases we wanted to discuss and give them some idea of what we had found. So we were forthcoming, and I felt like we were transparent.
Yes.
And in addition to that, I requested their sentencing recommendations for a certain number of cases. I was told that they didn't keep track of the sentencing recommendations. And, you know, they have a lot of cases, so, you know, maybe they don't. And then I was referred to the court transcripts for these cases.
Yeah.
The
right.
Transcripts can be pretty lengthy. And as I mentioned, I just looked at 4,000 documents. So the idea of looking at a lot of detailed court transcripts wasn't particularly appealing.
Yeah, but you might find what you were looking for eventually, but it would have been a long, hard slog.
It would have, and we are going to look at the court transcripts.
Yeah.
We're going to take them up on their suggestion,
yeah,
but not right now.
So when was the last chance that you gave? I mean, I believe your story posted yesterday?
Story posted on the web yesterday, and Craig's story ran on 11 o'clock last night. Yeah.
And did you give them one last chance before you went to air, went to to publish online?
I've given them chances as many times as I can. I've given them a chance again today.
I think the opportunity there, still stands.
You reach a point of diminishing returns.
It's a standing and open invitation.
Right.
But while the prosecutor would not talk to you, he did go on a major AM station yesterday with a well-known talk show host and basically told him that he finds your report hard to believe.
Well, there were times when I found the information hard to believe, but it's real and it's documented, and it's the prosecution's records. I mean, this is information provided by the prosecution, the judges, the police. I mean, this is the court record. So we're telling their story.
And I believe there was some – I mean, we talked about this off the air, the idea of a gun specification,
right,
that he couldn't believe that they would ever negotiate with a gun specification.
Right.
Right. I was asked the question on a radio show on WLW, and apparently the question had the word spec in it. I was on my cell phone in the middle of a noisy newsroom, and I was tired, and I did not hear the word spec when I was asked the question. That's not an excuse. I didn't hear it. I probably should have said something like, well, can you repeat the question? But I didn't. And I thought he was talking about weapons in general on these types of cases. And so the prosecutor got very upset over the fact that I had said, or I had responded to a question about whether or not specification cases had been dropped. And I said yes. And I was referring in general to weapons charges, that some of the weapons charges had been dropped. So he said that they would never drop specification charges. Well, specification charges have been dropped. I'm looking at a case right now, State of Ohio versus Tyon Price. Mr. Price was charged with, it looks like, at least 11 counts, including two for felonious assault with specifications. And as you can see, I'm handing you a printout of the sentence. What does it say happened to those two charges for specifications?
Well, let's see. There, at the bottom, it's highlighted 5 years Department of Corrections mandatory.
But up here.
Yeah. Oh, dismissal. Both are marked dismissal for count one and two, both marked dismissal.
All right. And so Mr. Price was charged with those charges because according to court records, he fired the firearm multiple times, causing the victim to be shot in the left side of the head and once in the left shoulder. And then Mr. Price fled the scene in a vehicle. He was also found with another weapon. He was found with cocaine, and I believe the amount of heroin he was found with exceeded 50 grams. So this is a major, major case.
But those specifications were dismissed, period.
Dismissed.
Would the information that you shared with the prosecutor prior to the going on the air and publishing, would it have included this case?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But again, our focus was not weapons in our first story.
Right.
Our focus was
it was a general
touch on the general approach to the story.
Well, we brought up the
he's weapons. The one. Right, right. But I mean, there it is. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison. I don't know how long they serve in Ohio. If good time is offered, do you? I mean, I don't know. Could he
not
be
off
out?
Off the top of my head, nope.
Four? I don't know, but. It seems likely that a case like this with a very large amount of narcotics and shooting somebody in the head could have led to a longer sentence in federal court.
And so we've heard things like, you know, each case has to be dealt with and considered, you know, differently because sometimes these plea deals include the decision for a plea was made because they're able to get further down the road, so to speak, in understanding where the biggest problems are and who the other big fish are, so to speak, if you will. And we understand that, but we really wanted to approach this just from that broad question, you know, what's happening to the individuals who are dealing drugs in our community? What kind of sentences are they facing? And does our community think that they're stiff enough? So that's what we've put out there.
And another good question I think that I would like to have answered is in the case of this fellow, if you dismiss charges and, you know, he ends up pleading out, where does it lead? Did it lead to some bigger fish?
Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah, nobody really knows.
Right. I mean, I think we all understand the role of an informant to some degree.
Uh-huh.
We don't know everything about these cases. I mean, we're not pretending to. And I'm sure some of them did provide some information that probably was helpful. But we don't know that, and we don't know which ones did that. And what we know is that the public record shows that there are people who have been convicted of dealing large amounts, relatively large amounts, who are getting probation. And there are people who are convicted of dealing very small amounts who have received prison.
Now, I know, I believe in your article or in your online story that you talked to the, I believe it's the Newtown police chief who is the head of the county's heroin task force. What's his takeaway on what you found?
Yeah, so we both interviewed him separately. And, you know, the way that he positioned it to me is the heroin epidemic is the most complicated issue that he has ever dealt with in his career. But these findings, these numbers are surprising and concerning, and they clearly show that what we're doing now isn't working. Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, and he has he's taken the initiative to contact lawmakers. And I guess he started on that about a year ago, trying to get someone to come up with, to create a law, write a law that made a distinction between carfentanil and fentanyl and heroin and have a stiffer penalty for that and also have a stiffer penalty for repeat offenders.
Yeah, more than a year ago, he and Dan Malloy, who is an officer up in Coleraine Township where they've been trying to do some really innovative things to tackle the heroin epidemic, wrote our lawmakers. What we've been able to do with these findings is really provide context to a problem that they saw well over a year ago and started lobbying lawmakers about. And I'll read you just a bit of a letter that Malloy wrote to our state lawmakers. He says the current penalties allow the dealers to serve little time and create an opportunity for them to return to their neighborhoods and streets to continue selling heroin. There's little reason for the cycle of dealing heroin to stop, knowing the reward far outweighs the risk. The people who are addicted and dying each day are paying the ultimate price. So this shouldn't come as a surprise necessarily to lawmakers that this is an incredible challenge for neighborhoods.
And one would assume that these officers have to walk a fine line with what they're telling you, but they also have to work with the prosecutor's office to prosecute these cases.
That's right.
I think law enforcement is very frustrated, and I think that but I also think many of the officers understand that it's complicated, it's expensive, and, you know, the system itself has to have priorities. It's tough.
Well, I mean, the police officers are not only preoccupied with getting these dealers off the street, they're preoccupied with trying to save some of these people who are, you know, the users out there. And that's taking up an enormous amount of police time and effort.
Yeah.
And resources.
You know, in Coleraine Township, for example, Malloy is among a group of folks that are that follow up with individuals who have overdosed. They get the records. They go to their homes. You know, here, so here you have a police officer who's showing up in an individual's home who had overdosed in just, you know, a few recent days. He's offering help, to assist them into treatment. Meanwhile, they're also trying to, you know, they're arresting these dealers. Yeah. So they're seeing this from, as you mentioned, Howard, every aspect.
You mentioned that you're going to, as Howard suggested, the grueling process of going through these transcripts. So I assume that's next. What else is going to happen now maybe to advance the story as you go forward?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of ways that we can advance it and move it in different directions, but with this common thread of, you know, are we seeing justice in this system? I think, you know, if we looked at enough cases, I think it would be fair to examine the rulings by judges. I think race is a huge issue here. I mean, just the 164 cases we found, 95-96% of the defendants are African American. I can't imagine in any scenario that 95-96% of the people who are selling heroin in Hamilton County are African American. I don't understand. But I think it's something that we should look at and figure out why that's happening, why that's the case.
But you might look at the judges themselves. I mean, you know, who's handling these cases, what they're doing with them.
We definitely have a good bit of that started already, sure.
I thought you might.
Yeah, but again, you know, judges' hands can be tied to an extent because of, the laws are written, but it would be worth knowing. Also worth knowing, traffickers compared to users, you know, and those who have just been caught with possession, so to speak,
right.
Are they being sentenced differently than these repeat trafficking offenders, so to speak?
Again, if you have a question or comment, 513-419-7100. We're going to move on for this topic in just a moment. But, Lisa, you said clearly that law enforcement says what you're doing now is not working. Did they have any suggestions that haven't been tried? Did they offer you any thoughts on here's what might help, here's what might work?
You know, what stood out to me is that they're looking for some leadership. They're looking for someone at a state lawmaker to take this issue up and consider stiffer penalties, especially for these fentanyl and carfentanil, and just push the system to whether it be get creative or really focus in on this particular issue of sentencing as it relates to the traffickers that continue to go back into our communities. So
we're going to move on and discuss some other headlines. And obviously, your story is online at WCPO.com. Lisa, I know you, I think, and if I embarrass myself, I'm embarrassing myself on the air, but I think you're well-versed in the business world.
Oh.
Talk about the significance that Macy's could be for sale.
You know, incredibly significant. I mean, think about Cincinnati, headquartered here in Cincinnati. When you look across Cincinnati's business landscape, P&G come to mind, Kroger comes to mind, Macy comes to mind, right? So those are our big heavy hitters. And In Cincinnati, a lot of folks who work for those companies, you know it because they wear the badge on their shirt, so to speak. They're proud to be sort of a part of that Cincinnati tradition. So the impact that that could have, you know, just here in Cincinnati, I think is enormous. Howard, do you want to weigh in?
Well, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, it's part of the identity of the city, as you know, are these kind of signature companies that have established themselves here. Now, you know, obviously before Macy's, it was Federated,
right?
And you know, it's evolved over the years, but you know, Macy's is a Cincinnati institution now.
Absolutely.
And I think the reports are that the parent company that owns Saks is perhaps interested in being the buyer for Macy's.
Yeah, as I understand it. Go ahead.
I was going to just say that the numbers, though, are, I mean, if the Enquirer was reporting that Macy's has 4,000 employees in the greater Cincinnati area and 1,000 of those are downtown, one would assume that if there was any thought that the headquarters leaves downtown, that is going to leave a huge void with 1,000 people leaving the downtown area.
Yeah, yeah. You know, typically deals like this are going – they play out over the course of years, so to speak. I mean,
that's
this one
true.
Might happen a little more quickly, but you're right. That would be an incredible impact. And not only in just, you know, sort of economically for Cincinnati, but that is – there is some incredible talent in Macy's. You think about Cincinnati as sort of a branding hub. We really market ourselves, again, because of P&G, because of Kroger. Macy's has always really fit into that. And so when you think about losing that kind of talent in a city, that can be a big blow.
Let's move on to – did you want to add something, Howard?
No, no.
Another thing that happened that occupied a lot of airtime and newspaper print this week is now Cincinnati is officially – a sanctuary city. And
yes.
Howard, you covered the first part of this for us.
Yeah.
I tried to get you to cover the part Wednesday, and you told me no.
Do you get away with telling him no?
Yeah.
Emphatically no. So walk us through. This started Monday with a press conference with Mayor Cranley.
Well, this actually started some time ago. I mean, you know, really, the fact is, you know, we are now have declared ourselves a sanctuary city. Nothing really has changed. You know, for the past few years, the policy of the Cincinnati Police Department has been not to enforce immigration laws. They don't go around, you know, making traffic stops and wanting to look at people's documentation, immigration status, and that kind of thing. We have programs like the ID cards from the Metropolitan Area Religious Coalition and the Chamber's Compass program, which kind of helps immigrants come into the city and kind of integrate themselves, find jobs. And, you know, none of that's changed. The only thing that's changed is this designation as a sanctuary city. And that has no legal standing whatsoever. There is no such a legal entity as a sanctuary city. It's just what you call yourself. And it's how a city behaves and how it operates. And that can mean many different things in many different cities. That's why there are, you know, something like 300 of them across the country. So there had been efforts, you know, Yvette Simpson, a council member who was also a candidate for mayor, she and Chris Seelbach have been working on a plan on Sanctuary City. Yvette told me that, you know, suddenly she was going to meet Monday. She and Seelbach were going to meet with stakeholders in this Monday afternoon. And suddenly the mayor called a press conference and made this big announcement that we're suddenly now a sanctuary city. And there were a whole lot of people there from all religious backgrounds, from all ethnic and national backgrounds. People were jubilant about this thing, and Yvette Simpson was there. You know, now she's saying, "Well, so I don't care." He got out in front of it, but you know, mainly the idea is it's done. It's a good thing for the city.
And when you talk about that it has no force of law, it was actually passed as a council resolution, which
right.
if you want to pass a law in Cincinnati, it has to be an ordinance.
Right. And she still wants to pass ordinances to put laws on the books regarding immigration and immigration status. Now, you know, there's this question of whether or not the Trump administration is going to follow through with this threat to pull federal funding from cities that declare themselves sanctuary cities. That's one of these things that's going to be very difficult. If you've got federal funding that's already been appropriated to the city of Cincinnati, there's nothing Donald Trump can do about that. That money is coming to Cincinnati. If he tried to pull it back, city could go to court and they would likely win. However, in the future, if he could convince Congress just to not appropriate money to cities like Cincinnati who have taken on this status and Congress goes along with it, then it could cost the city a great deal of money and money for big projects, you know, Brent Spence Bridge, the Western Hills Viaduct, all of these things.
Lisa, did you want to?
Yeah, and that's what I was going to pick up on. I think it was Andrew Pappas out in Anderson Township who began raising the flag about that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, to pull back federal funding for something like the Brent Spence Bridge, I mean, a project that I believe Trump came to town and said he was going to see
right.
through.
Yeah.
That would seem like a tough call to make, but.
Well, especially because he would have to convince people like Mitch McConnell and Rob Portman to go along with something that would be clearly not in the best interests of their constituencies.
Sure.
Period.
Yeah.
And the Republicans had their response to this on Tuesday.
Tuesday.
State
right.
Treasurer Josh Mandel said it was going to be passed over his dead body, I believe, was the comment.
Well, he's still living.
and then Steve
it's
Chabot.
It's passed, but Josh Mandel is still alive and well and running for the United States Senate.
And Steve Chabot said that the city was walking the plank with this
right.
sanctuary city.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe. We don't know yet. I mean, it's like I said, you know, the Trump administration, they probably cannot take away the money that's already been appropriated to the city, federal funding, but they could influence Congress to cut off certain funding for these sanctuary cities. But that remains to be seen, and all of it would have to be fought out in the courts.
Some of it, I think, is political. But I think there's also a genuine pushback on outside agencies
right.
basically leaning on local police departments, whether it's, you know, the feds or state, you know, departments of corrections who need help picking up probation or parole violators. I mean, a lot of police chiefs around the country are saying, look, fellas, you know, you go pick them up. We got plenty to do here in our own community. We don't have enough time and money and people. So that's part of the pushback, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We're going to have to work in another break, and Lisa and Craig need to depart. Thank you both for being here. Lisa Bernard-Kuhn is a issues reporter for WCPO.com, WCPO Insiders, and Craig Cheatham, the executive producer and chief investigative reporter for Channel 9. We again are talking about local news headlines, and Howard and I will continue our discussion after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in for Mark Haney. We're talking about this week's local news stories. And, of course, Lisa and Craig have departed. So it's just me
and
our politics reporter, Howard Wilkinson. I said if we run out of material, I'm going to start telling puns. Howard informs me that he will never run out of material.
I will talk and talk and talk, Jay.
If you have a question or comment, 513-419-7100. Or you can email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Howard, let's pick back up on before the break. We were talking about the sanctuary city and the role of Mayor Cranley, and you were talking about Yvette Simpson. Clearly, a lot of this was about the mayor's race.
Yes.
The politics of the mayor's race.
Well, there's no question about it, and I think, you know— from John Cranley's point of view, it was probably a smart idea to do this at the time he did to get out in front of this issue. Because Yvette Simpson, who was running against him, she supports this idea and was working towards some sort of legislation. Rob Richardson, the third Democrat who was running for mayor, is obviously not on council. He didn't have a vote on this, but he supports the sanctuary city concept. So, but John Cranley sort of appropriated this issue, and it's his now. And it's not a bad issue to have if you're running for mayor in the city of Cincinnati, because you have to understand that this is an extremely Democratic city. It is very, very Democratic. The Republican vote doesn't make a whole lot of difference. I mean, you go back to November election, just within the city of Cincinnati in the presidential election, Hillary Clinton won 73% of the vote in the city of Cincinnati. Donald Trump won 21% within the city of Cincinnati. So, you can see this is a very Democratic city. And to become mayor or to win another term as mayor, you have to build support among that Democratic base.
And we have Jordan calling with a question. Jordan, go ahead. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Yes, hello. I have heard that Republicans are planning to put this issue on the ballot, either a referendum on the question itself that was called before council, or possibly to change the city charter and define that this city will defer to the federal government in terms of immigration policy. I understand that the Republicans are a small minority, but they all voted for John Cranley when he ran against Roxanne Qualls in his last election. And this is a dividing issue that could be very powerful if that 21%, they still represent well over 40,000 votes, and it takes about 30,000 votes to put someone on council. Will that make a difference in this election if the Republicans do that? And have you heard anything about that movement?
I have not heard anything.
No, not really. No, I haven't seen much on that, and I've been watching social media.
Can you referendum a resolution?
No.
I know you can referendum an ordinance.
An ordinance you can, but I'm not sure resolution. About a resolution. I'm not sure they'd have status to be able to do that at this point. But, yes, you're right. There is a block of Republican votes out there, and in the 2013 election, obviously John Cranley won most of those votes when he was running against Roxanne Qualls. But he's a guy who has also been having trouble with that Democratic base over a number of issues over the last several years, and this is a very good way for him to reestablish his connections with the progressive type wing of the party. So, you can't ignore that 21%, but that 21% is probably not going to decide this primary election on May 2nd.
Jordan, we appreciate that phone call. Some other media outlets this week were talking about the fundraising reports in the mayor's race.
Mm-hmm.
And not surprisingly, John Cranley has a pretty good size war chest. Tell us about the numbers.
Well, at the end of the year, John Cranley had about $965,000 in the bank. That's a lot of money. And they've been saying that he could raise as much as $2.5 million for this entire election cycle, which would be astronomical in terms of the city's history. I mean, Yvette Simpson got into the race, a little bit late, but she's raised about $188,000. She says, okay, I'm not going to have as much money as John Cranley, but we're going to run a grassroots campaign. And Rob Richardson didn't declare until January 3rd, so he's just in the beginning stages of trying to raise money. If John Cranley raised, say, $2.5 million, not only for this primary election but for the general election, that would be by far a record in Cincinnati. The old record was in 2005 when David Pepper raised $1.2 million, when he was running against Mark Mallory. Who won that election?
Mark Mallory.
That's correct. And he didn't spend that much money. So money doesn't always buy happiness in politics. I mean, you know, it's good to have, but, you know, you got to spend it the right way. And one of the problems that Cranley could face is if this primary election becomes very competitive, he's going to have to spend a lot of that money too. He's already spending some of it.
We have a call from Debbie. Debbie, go ahead. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to get your thoughts on the issue where the FBI seized the boxes from Charlie Winburn's office. The whole thing just seems so bizarre to me. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on whether there's meat to the story or if it was just a political ploy.
Howard, Boxgate, well, as Mr. Winburn likes to call it.
Right. Well, you know, Debbie, I don't know, to tell you the truth. That is not clear at all what exactly that was about. You know, there were phone calls made. You know, these boxes were discovered in the basement of City Hall. Winburn's aide had put them there. She was going to take them home and sort them out, saying that there were just insignificant, you know, old newspapers and, you know, materials that really didn't matter. And the city solicitor brought the police in. The police contacted the FBI. The FBI ended up getting a hold of these boxes. And then they turned it over to the Ohio Attorney General and his Bureau of Criminal Investigation, which just looked at it, said, threw up their hands, said, we're not going to prosecute anybody here. We're not going to prosecute Charlie Winburn, so we're going to send these boxes back. And they sent them back. And so he held this press conference just celebrating his vindication.
That he got his five boxes back.
And he got his five boxes back.
Real quickly, because we're running out of time, a couple other things I want to get to. Charlie Winburn has petitions out to run for mayor.
Yes, he does.
Do you think he will run for mayor?
I don't know. You know, there's some speculation that he's probably just trying to annoy John Cranley because, you know, if he did get on the ballot, he would, you know, conceivably take some votes away from Cranley. Those Republicans in the city that our previous caller had talked about. I don't know. With Charlie, you never know, okay?
And no.
The filing deadline is February 16th at 4 p.m., and that's when we'll know.
Real quickly, we found out today that former Hamilton County Commissioner Greg Hartman has been recommended by Ohio's two senators to be the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Ohio.
That's correct.
Quite an honor there.
It's a big job. Now, this is a appointment that has to be made by the president. They are recommending Greg Hartman to President Trump. President Trump will have to actually make, you know, the nomination. Now, he could do something else if he wants to. But if he does nominate Hartman, then it has to go through Senate confirmation. And, you know, it's likely that he would be confirmed.
And obviously, this could have come from just one senator, Senator Portman.
Right.
What's the implication or the thought that it actually came from both Ohio senators, one a Democrat, one a Republican?
Well, I think, you know, they both agreed on this, that, you know, that Hartman is qualified for this. A president gets to choose his or her own U.S. attorney, and they're keeping the same U.S. marshal who, you know, Senator Brown, the Democrat, I'm sure, supports.
Howard, we've reached the end of our time for our Friday news review, and I don't get to do any puns.
No, that's too bad.
WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. Earlier, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn, and executive producer and chief investigative reporter for Channel 9, Craig Cheatham, were with us. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available on our website, wvxu.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier. Our technical producer, or assistant producer, rather, was Belinda Kai. Technical director was Dave Shermer. I'm Jay Hanselman. A pleasure to fill in for Mark Haney today. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening to 91.7 WVXU.
If you would like to dress up your yard this spring, now is the time to learn how to plan your landscape. On the next Cincinnati edition, we'll preview the Cincinnati Zoo's upcoming gardening and landscaping classes. We'll also hear why dieting isn't the best way to stay healthy. And in Focus on Technology, muscles in your face may be the solution to strengthening your heart. That's Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 o'clock on 91.7 WVXU.